This is a continuation of the series, Counseling for the Parish Pastor. The subject of this cassette is Categories of Communication. I am Paul Baumeister. I'm a minister and a clinical psychologist. A question that comes up frequently from pastoral counselors is, what do I say next? The pastor says, my counselor tells me what his problem is. I understand his problem, but then I don't know what to say next, and therefore don't feel that I know how to help him very well. A useful way to think about counseling is as a series of signals of communication that pass back and forth between the counselee and the counselor. Today we're going to look at five different kinds of responses on the counselor's side of the communication. These five are theological responses, listening responses, directive responses, interpretive responses, and finally nonverbal responses. Shortly after that, we will be ready to turn the tape over and look at the other side of the counseling process, namely the counselee's side. We're really not attempting to be exhaustive with these categories. Undoubtedly, there are other categories of counseling communication. What we're after today are the biggies. Also along the way, we're going to be asking you to stop the machine from time to time to put in some of your own material. If you're listening to this with a group, this can be done in a group. If you're doing it by yourself, it might help keep you honest if you would write your responses down on a piece of paper. Okay, let's start off with category one, the theological response. While it's not the unique property of the pastoral counselor, it certainly is an area where he feels more at home than a lot of people in the counseling business, and an area of special strength and expertise that isn't possessed by everybody. Talking in theological language is difficult when you consider the wide variety of meanings that single theological words can have for people. Basically, I see two kinds of theological responses that the pastor might use. One is a supportive response, and the other is a confronting response. Put that into more conventional theological language, one is gospel, and the other is law. If the pastor were to say, the Lord is aware of your difficulties and of your efforts, that would be a theological statement. He's talking about God and about you, and what he's trying to do with that statement is support you, make you feel better about what's going on in your life. On the other hand, if the pastor were to say, God calls that kind of activity sin, that would also be a theological statement, this time a confronting one, that's not designed to make you feel better. It is designed to make you change the behavior. The pastor need not refer to God directly or quote scripture in order to be dealing theologically with people. He could, for example, refer to the moral teachings of the church and say, down through the ages, the church has been very lenient toward that, or there was a time during the church's history when that was frowned upon, but it no longer is. These will also be theological responses, as well as ones that speak more directly about God or quote the scripture. Now in a minute, I'd like you to turn the machine off and see if you can recall a recent pastoral care situation in which you were attempting to be supportive with theological language. If you are in a group of several people, perhaps some of them would wish to share their theologically supportive sentence briefly with the group. If you are by yourself, write down your theologically supportive sentence on a piece of paper. Then evaluate it. How well did it do the job of supporting the person? Did it work? Could it have been improved if you had used some special theological words or quoted scripture or been more direct in your language? Spend about 5 minutes on this task. All right, turn off the machine. Some people think that not enough theological confronting goes on these days. Perhaps in your discussion, you got to that kind of theological statement already. If not, you might want to think about it a bit more. Do you ever do theological confronting? When you do it, does it work? And you do it well. This is sometimes called using pastoral authority. That is, the authority of the office or the authority of the word. In certain circumstances, with certain people, theological confrontation can be a very helpful and effective thing to do. I've heard of situations where rather messy marriage relationship was straightened out rather quickly with some strong theological confrontation. With other people, in other situations, theological confrontation can generate a great deal of indignation and resentment, as well as very strong resistance. Let's move on now to the second category of responding, the listening responses. There are several, and their basic intent is to keep the counselee talking and keeping aware of what he's talking about and aware of the fact that you are listening to him, that you're paying attention. The first category of listening response is the old chestnut that Carl Rogers talked a great deal about, namely reflection. The counselee says, "Oh, Pastor, I just don't know what to do. Everywhere I turn, someone turns on me," and then pauses. Our pastor might well listen to that pause for a while and then reflect what's been said to him. He might say, "You feel that no one cares." A very simple reflection of the feeling that is being expressed. The reflective category of listening response has been so well discussed and elaborated by others that we won't spend much more time on it here. We move along to the second category of listening response, which is called a probing response. Suppose you've been listening, and possibly you need some details that have been omitted somewhere along the line. There's a rather high likelihood that the details that were omitted were not factual ones, but were emotional ones. And the counselor asks a question like, "What do you feel when he treats you this way?" What he's doing is probing. He's directing the counselee's attention to a specific element in his situation. Interestingly enough, this kind of question frequently draws a blank because people don't have feeling language at their disposal. So you may have to carry your probing a bit farther and even supply some of the words and ask, "Do you feel angry, or upset, or unhappy, or irritated? What do you feel when he treats you this way?" Some research on counseling suggests that beginning counselors ask a lot of questions and that their questions tend to make people uneasy, possibly even defensive. You might want to watch that as you counsel. If you are using way too many probing responses, you might want to try to slow that down a bit. It's amazing how well people can tell their own story if let alone to do it. A third category of listening response is rather like probing. I call it clarifying because it seems to come at things in a broader fashion. When you've been listening carefully and have heard things that don't seem to fit together or something doesn't make sense to you, that's the point at which to ask a clarifying kind of question. An example would be for a pastor to say, "You said you were afraid, but you were also glad when you won that prize. I don't understand." Like the probing response, it is basically a request for more information, possibly pointing up a lack of clarity on the counselee's part. Another kind of listening response is the summary. And the counselee seems to have little difficulty in expressing himself when he talks rather freely, when he sticks to the point. Counselor's task is relatively easy. He listens. When the counselor has finished his recital, the counselor can signal to him that he's been paying attention by summarizing what's been said. A sentence like, "Well now, it seems to me that what you said is, or he might say, the situation as you see it is so and so. Another kind of listening response that is completely legitimate and probably not used very much because people don't think about it is to ask to have things told again. A listening repetitive response. An example of this would be for the counselor to say, you told me before how you got along with your sister. Would you tell me that again, please? The counselor would be listening for differences in the story, for phrases that appear in both tellings, or for themes that appear. The counselee goes over the same material again, perhaps a bit more carefully this time, sometimes discovering new ideas or even new connections as he does this. The final two kinds of listening responses are ones in which the counselor adds something from himself. I call the first a sanctioning response. You've been listening. Somebody's been talking about something they feel rather heavy about, let's say. At the end of that recital, the counselor says, my goodness, Mary, that sure sounds okay to me. It has some of the same intent behind it as a theologically supportive statement, but this time we're talking about our own values. The final kind of listening response is the listening instructive response. At this point, the counselor assumes rather clearly the role of teacher and begins to talk about how things are in the real world. For example, if a young mother had been talking with great trepidation about the angry feelings she sometimes has towards her six-month-old child, this lady is in need of some instruction. And our pastor might say to her, it is not at all unusual for parents to be angry with their children at times, even very angry. Children are very frustrating creatures. He sounds like a teacher as he does this. In a moment, we will again ask you to turn off the machine and respond to a situation. Imagine now a 35-year-old housewife you have been counseling with about her marriage problems. She says to you,
Pastor, my husband gets so frustrated and angry at work, but he can't sit. Then he comes home and starts hollering and thrashing around the house. I know I can't say anything, because if I do, he'll go out and get drunk just to punish me. When that happens, I feel so awful, and then my head starts to hurt again.
Respond to this statement with as many of the listening responses as you can. If you're in a group, take turns. If by yourself, write them down. If possible, use a reflective statement, a probing statement, a clarifying statement, a summarizing statement, a sanctioning statement, and an instructive statement. Here's the sentence one more time.
Pastor, my husband gets so frustrated and angry at work, but he can't sit. Then he comes home and starts hollering and thrashing around the house, and I know I can't say anything because if I do, he'll go out and get drunk just to punish me. When that happens, I feel so awful, and then my head starts to hurt again.
All right, turn off the machine. How well did you do? Did you get them off? Did one statement seem better than the others for that situation? Possibly you might be more comfortable reflecting than probing. Now we move along to the next category, which is directive statements. We're going to talk about three kinds of directive statements: structuring, suggesting, and demanding. We separate the structuring statements because they perform a specific function in the counseling relationship. Structuring statements either alter the relationship or call attention to a prior agreement about it. When the counselor sets his contract with the counselee, he is structuring. He is altering the pastoral relationship that had existed before to allow a counseling process to take place. Structuring has to do with, you will remember, time, place, duration, counselor's behavior, and the content of the conversation. A simple example of a structuring statement would be, Mrs. Miller, I will meet you here for the next 7 Thursday afternoons at 3 o'clock. We will meet for an hour each time, and we will talk about your relationship with your daughter-in-law. You will be telling me how you feel about it. I will be listening and asking questions. We will meet for an hour each time. Toward the end of the 7 hours, we'll discuss whether or not this is helpful to you. Does that sound agreeable to you, Mrs. Miller? Our counselor is structuring rather carefully. Along about interview number 5, he might say another structuring statement. He might say, no, Mrs. Miller, I don't think you should quit coming. We agreed on 7 times, and this is only the 5th time. Why don't we stick together as we had agreed? On the 7th hour, he might have more structuring to do. He might say, well, Mrs. Miller, this is the last time we meet. This is what we had agreed. I know you would like to continue, but since our initial goals were met and we've been unable to set any new ones, I feel we should terminate at this time. Structuring is takeover behavior on the part of the counselor. It is quite necessary if he's going to control a relationship and use his relationship with people in a way that will be helpful to them. The second category of directive communication I call suggesting, and it differs from demanding, as you might have guessed, in that it is not quite as strong. In a marriage counseling situation, I can't imagine our counselor saying, you know, it seems as though the two of you start a fight every Friday evening, at last till Sunday evening. It is really very unpleasant and rather expensive. Have you ever considered not starting it? This is a suggestion, possibly a new idea to these folks. It assumes that the counselor has some control over his behavior, control he may not have recognized. The final category of directive responding is demanding. In this, the counselor uses whatever authority he might have, his authority as a person, his authority in his office, and theological authority, if necessary, to take over a segment of the counselee's life and run it for him. An example would be, George, you must not stop at that tavern on the way home. Don't even go down that street. Go around the block on the other side. This is very controlling behavior on the counselor's part, and I imagine that most of us would use it with great moderation, and even at that, it's not going to work all the time. It has the effect of putting the counselor in toughest place, and therefore making you, the counselor, the target for the same kind of resistance that works against Papa. Now, in a moment, I'll ask you to turn off the machine again. But first, let's go back to that lady we were dealing with at the end of the section on the listening responses. You remember the lady who was talking about her husband getting angry at work? Let's hear once again what she has to say.
Pastor, my husband gets so frustrated and angry at work that he can't share. Then he comes home and starts hollering and thrashing around the house, and I know I can't say anything, because if I do, he'll go out and get drunk just to punch him. When that happens, I feel so awful, and then my head starts to hurt again.
Respond to her now with 3 directive responses. The first, a structuring, where you talk about your relationship with her. The second, a suggesting directive response. And the third, a demanding directive response. Here is our lady again.
Pastor, my husband gets so frustrated and angry at work that he can't share it. Then he comes home and starts hollering and thrashing around the house, and I know I can't say anything, because if I do, he'll go out and get drunk just to punch me. When that happens, I feel so awful, and then my head starts to hurt again.
Okay, turn off the machine. were you able to get all three? The most difficult, possibly, was the structuring response. However, you might have said to her, we're not here to talk about your husband's problems. We're here to talk about your problems. Tell me some more about that headache. That would have been a structuring response. Now on to the next category of interpretive responses. An interpretive response is possible when a counselor has been doing his hard intellectual work. He's been tuned in, he's been paying attention, and he's been thinking about what goes on. The first kind of interpretive response is that of people, and it's called labeling. Suppose your counselee had talked at length about a problem and about his feeling of embarrassment or shame over his problem. And at this point, the counselor can attach to the problem a label, hopefully one that is less loaded than the one the counselee is using. For example, if a young mother is talking about her difficulties in surviving with three very small children in the house and has described this in her terms as her, quote, failure as a mother, a very helpful label to put on this would be, quote, parental frustration. Of course, the implication is that this is common, that every parent has it, and she's not the only one. She's not the first, and hers is not the worst. There are occasions on which the appropriate labeling of a simple emotion can be very helpful. People do, on occasion, mislabel their own emotion. To say to someone, what you are calling rage sounds more like fear as I listen to it, could be a very relieving, uplifting, enlightening kind of statement. The second category of interpretive responses I call linking. At times, the counselor links the past with the present. For example, the feeling you have when your boss corrects you is the same feeling you had when you were a little girl and your father scolded you. This links the past with the present. Possibly a more important kind of interpretive linking response links present with present. As we listen carefully to people talk about their lives, patterns begin to emerge, their behavior patterns. An example of linking present to present would be the following. When your husband scowls at you, you want to cry, but instead you lash out at him. What the counselor is doing with this linking is putting together things that belong together, that the counselee has not put together for himself. A third kind of interpretive statement I call confronting. This has the connotation that the person will see something he's not going to like seeing. What you're going to say to him is something that's not very flattering. It might be very true and might be very helpful to know about. For example, if you were to say, you know, Bill, you've told me many times that you work so hard because you want your family to have all the things you didn't have. I wonder sometimes, Bill, if you work so hard possibly because you like to work, because it makes you feel good. That could be a confrontation that might be very helpful to Bill. He also might not like you for making it. You're attacking some of his lofty ideas about himself. Think once again about the lady whose husband comes home from work angry. She feels that she can't speak to him about it because he will drink and this produces headaches for her. Respond to her this time with some labeling and then with some interpretive linking statements. Make up whatever material you need in order to generate a linking statement, past to present and present to present. Then try a confrontation. Four different kinds of statements, labeling, past and present linking, and confrontation. Here's our lady again.
Pastor, my husband gets so frustrated and angry at work that he can't kill it. Then he comes home and starts hollering and thrashing around the house, and I know I can't say anything, because if I do, he'll go out and get drunk just to punish me. When that happens, I feel so awful, and then my head starts to hurt again.
All right. sin after the sin. The fifth category of pastoral response is called nonverbal. And while this is an important one, we're not going to spend much time on it because it's rather self-evident. There are three different kinds of nonverbal response. There's the nonverbal vocal response. That's where you make sounds that aren't really words. And you say, clear your throat. Then there's the facial responses, and that's whatever is going on in your face as you listen to people. Sometimes we get some surprising feedback on that when someone says, why are you frowning? We frown, we grimace, we smile, we offer penetrating gazes or faraway looks. And finally, there's the postural response that you make as people talk to you. Do you slouch? Are your feet on the desk? Are you sitting at attention? Are you holding your head? Are you looking out of the window? All of this communicates to your counselee just as clearly, and at times way more clearly, than your verbal responses do. Finally, let's talk about two categories of response to be avoided. The first is a defensive response. It's not very difficult to make people behave in a defensive way. Generally, all you have to do is attack them a little bit. At times in counseling, your counselee may attack you, or you may think he's attacking you. The counselee brings to the pastoral counselor a host of assumptions about the pastor's value system and belief system, and he may be surprised to learn otherwise from his pastor as he's counseling with him. This could produce a rather vigorous attack and cause our pastor to go into a tailspin of defensive behavior about how he arrived at his theological position or his ethical system. If you find yourself wandering into deep theological water while you're in a counseling situation, using big words, possibly even arguing, chances are you're being defensive. You can feel the hair stand up on the back of your neck. When that happens, the next thing you say, there's a high likelihood of being a defensive sentence. Defensiveness on the part of the counselor really doesn't move the counseling process along. The second kind of error is that of expressing shock. Goodness gracious, I can't believe that you did so and so. The hallmark of a good counselor is that he's virtually shock-proof, but it's a bit difficult to be genuinely shock-proof. All that really matters is you don't signal your shock to the people you're talking to. Just for fun, you might want to try to write down some defensive statements, of course not any you've ever made in a counseling situation, and some shock statements, again, not any you've ever really said. We've been talking about the counselor's communication in pastoral counseling. We've talked about five different kinds of responses. Theological response, a listening response, a directive response, an interpretive response, and a nonverbal response. We talk about two errors, the errors of being defensive and the errors of indicating shock. On the other side of this tape, we will be discussing the counselee's communications to the counselor. This concludes this lesson. Run your cassette forward until it stops, and begin the opposite side for the next lesson. Now I look at the other side of the question here. There are all statements made by the counselee. We will be talking about basically two kinds of statements. The first kind is the kind that moves the counselee along, now helps do the work that the counselor and counselee have come to do. The second kind of statement is the opposite of that, and it would involve stalling or thwarting or frustrating the work of counseling. We have two categories here, working statements and resisting statements. When we talk about resisting, we are making no assumptions about the counselee's intentions. We fully believe that he is there because he wants help. However, he brings with him to the counseling situation all his usual ways of avoiding pain and fear and sweat that the situation may generate for him. We might say they are very human ways. This causes him to resist the painful, fearful, threatening work of counseling. Let's look now at some of the working statements that the counselor might make. The first category we call exploring responses. When a counselee says,
"I've never really thought about how I felt in that situation. Let me see."
And then proceeds to examine feelings in an imagined or a real situation. That's an exploring response. The work of counseling is going on. He is thinking new thoughts about the situation, trying to figure it out, examining his own motivation, his own emotions. Exploring statements provide some of the more interesting moments. Third category of working statement is a reliving statement. This is like remembering, but it has added to it a stronger emotional component. The counselor may say,
"I remember what it was like. It was just awful. Everyone was looking at me and I didn't know what to say. And then I started to choke up and I couldn't even talk."
And you notice as she speaks that she's really experiencing the emotions that were hers the first time around. Once again, strong emotional impact is upsetting to many people, and our counselee may need some support as she relives this experience. A fourth category of working statement is an exposing statement. This occurs in a situation where a person makes himself vulnerable. He tells you something about himself that he wouldn't readily admit to a stranger. Generally, this has to do with either acts or emotions from the past that the counselee feels ashamed of. These might be emotions directed towards others or those directed towards himself. For example, the counselee might say, such a statement exposes one to the kind of reaction that might have occurred on the playground when the person was younger. When following such a statement, the other kids would say, "You are weird, ha ha ha." Of course, that's not going to happen in the counseling room, and the counselee needs to learn this from experience. Again, an exposing statement like that might well require some support from the counselor. Patient listening is awfully good support. Some of the listening responses would be helpful here. The fifth category of working statement is venting. This is the conventional blowing off steam. It can be very necessary as a part of the process if we're to get beyond it and down to something that can be managed. Name calling, fist pounding, tears, loud angry talk, or the opposite kind of emotional signal, twisting, tightness, grimacing, stiff, rigid, punctuated speech, can all be very appropriate in the counseling room when some important venting is going on. The counseling might say,
"I get so angry just thinking about it. It was so unfair of him to take advantage of that situation. It was just lousy and crummy, too."
That's venting. Again, following some venting statements, the counselee might feel quite vulnerable, having exposed some things he regards as rather nasty to the counselor. to discover that such nasty feelings are not at all that unusual might be helpful. The counselor might say, angry feelings are really not negotiable, they're just there in all of us. When the counselee is working and making noises like these we've been talking about, there's generally no great need for the counselor to do much other than listen and support. The listening responses and the theological supporting responses would be entirely appropriate. Being aware of the counselee's feelings of vulnerability is a rather important item for the counselor. Too much support can make people feel just as uncomfortable as too little, so it is best dealt out in measured doses. We've been talking about the working responses, exploring, remembering, reliving, exposing, and venting. Now let's have a look at the resisting responses on the part of the counselee. These are the ones by which he attempts to avoid or divert the work of counseling. The first category we want to look at is denial. People just say, it ain't so. Suppose now that you've been talking with your counselee about her feelings towards her 20-year-old daughter. You have just tried what you thought was a low-level interpretation and said that it sounded to you as though sometimes she's rather angry with her daughter. She responds and says to you,
but it might be a bit defensive. Really, we could rephrase and try another interpretation using the word upset rather than the word angry, which seems to be unacceptable to her. Angry tends to rouse her defenses. Or we might want to try a more direct confrontation there and talk about her angry feelings toward you. You did feel a little angry, didn't you? We might need to talk about how the daughter, finding that the God-pleasing way to live her life is really her task and not the task for another to perform. Or, since there seems to be a control issue involved here, you might want to confront that rather directly and suggest that this lady stops trying to run the daughter's life. In any event, denial is rather difficult to deal with, and it should signal to the counselor the size of the task you have to perform. Let's move on now to another kind of resisting response. Suppose that our counselor has been working with this lady for some 9 or 10 hours. She comes regularly, she's always on time, she follows all her suggestions, and she thinks she's just wonderful. Imagine that it's the beginning of the counseling hour. Our counselor has just made a brief speech about the 12-session contract, and how this is hour 11, and that there will be 1 hour next week, and then they will quit as previously agreed. He has given her his evaluation of the progress. She had wanted to be happier, and he had suggested that she could be more active, which she tried for a while with some success. However, the last 2 weeks her reports have not been quite so happy. Now she says,
"Well, see, when I think about coming on here and having some of this, I feel this time and wrong. I just can't suggest coming on that wrong. I can't make it alone."
All right, Pastor, come off the machine and respond to that. Did it make you feel good? Did it possibly make you feel too good? Because I'm going to call that a dependent response. She's telling the counselor that she really can't get along without him. A number of the listening responses would be appropriate for this. merely reflecting to her how she feels would be a first step. A counselor might say, you are dependent on me. Challenging the depth and importance of this dependence might be a reasonable next step to do. She could say, you feel some dependence, but you really know that you could get along without me. A linking and confronting interpretation with past or present dependency feelings might be helpful. He might say, you are leaning on me in much the same way that you try to lean on your husband. Dependency feelings in counseling are very common and need to be labeled and confronted if short-term counseling is to be effective. Suppose now that your counselee has just told you a lengthy story about an argument with a 20-year-old daughter. Suppose you had said, okay, that's the story. How do you understand it now? You are probing for what all this has meant to her and how she feels about it. But instead you get an answer like this.
Oh, Pastor, I understand it perfectly. My parent keeps taking over every time my adult tries to talk to my daughter's adult. And her child keeps responding to my parent. It's a cross-communication that usually escalates anger on both sides. It sure helps a lot, though, to be able to explain it all in PA language.
Okay, Pastor, turn off the machine and respond to her. What you probably know is that it doesn't help much at all to explain it in PA language because she's intellectualizing. Other kinds of language could be substituted for the transactional analysis language. She could talk about ego, superego, and id. She could talk about her good self and her bad self. Or she could explain this behavior in terms of unresolved complexes or developmental crises. In the final analysis, which set of words she chooses to use doesn't make a great deal of difference because what she's doing is avoiding the feeling side of her being. She could also talk about how the devil makes her do it, or how about her old evil flesh gets in the way, and make it all sound as though she is a helpless pawn of forces outside her. A reflective statement at this point might be a low-key way of challenging her thought, but it really helps a great deal to be able to talk about it in this way. You might say, you feel it really helps you to understand it in these terms? Or you could probe a bit and say, can you tell me how it helps to understand it in these terms? Most likely those two would be too low key to get anywhere, and you might be much more interested in interpretation at this point. A labeling response that calls this intellectualizing, or a head trip, if you will, might help a bit more. You might try a confrontation that says, I don't think this helps very much at all. Or you might pick up on her word anger and ask her to tell you about the anger as she feels it, and to make sure she talks about her anger and not her daughter's. Many people in our day and time are intellectualizers. We all do it some. It's part of our world to want to know and to understand things, and we build theories and systems about how and why. In fact, there can be some real advantage in a person understanding his internal emotional workings. Where the trouble comes is when intellectualizing becomes a substitute for feeling and expressing feelings. That's not going to work. Let's move along now to another kind of resistance. Suppose you've been working with a lady and her husband for some 3 hours about their marital difficulties, and in order to get all the cards out on the table, you had suggested that one alternative among several open to them was divorce. At this point, she responds to you by saying,
I'm surprised that a pastor would feel that way about something the Bible clearly says is wrong. Doesn't the Bible say that divorce is sin? People told me you had some different ideas, and I said, give him a chance to prove himself. Now I see what they mean, and I must say I'm disgusted.
Okay, Pastor, can you get out of this one? Turn off the machine and write down your response. I call this an attacking response on her part. It tends to make the counselor defensive. You might be tempted to make an elaborate speech about your personal theology of marriage and divorce, but probably wouldn't be very productive at this point. A simple reflective statement might be helpful. You could say, you feel as though I'm pushing you in a direction you don't want to go, or the thought of divorce really upsets you. Or a probing statement might help, like, I wonder if you can tell us why divorce upsets you so. She also might feel pretty vulnerable right about this time too, and that might be what's triggering her attack on you. If you could say, you're upset, and I'm glad you let us know that. It tells us we're talking about some things that are terribly important to you. This could be a kind of supportive help. A labeling interpretation might also be appropriate. You might say, you sound afraid when you talk like that. Or a linking interpretation which says, the uneasiness and anger you feel right now is similar to the uneasiness and anger you feel when your husband goes on his hunting trip in the fall. Or you might want to use a structuring statement at this point and say, we're not here really to talk about marriage in general or divorce in general. We're here to talk about your marriage. Another category of response, somewhat like the attack, but perhaps a bit more difficult to deal with, would be the following. Again, suppose a marriage counseling situation about the sixth interview. Things have not been going well. There's been no striking improvement in the marriage, and at this point, the wife says,
it just isn't working. I mean, we come here every week and try to do everything you say, and nothing happens. I said to Fred when we first started, maybe we should go to a psychiatrist or at least a social worker. But he said, let's try the pastor. I guess pastors just don't know enough about helping people.
All right, pastor, respond to that one. Turn off the machine and write down your response. How did you handle it? A reflective statement might help. You feel like we're not getting anywhere. Or a probing that would suggest that she might have more to say about her frustration. Or an instructive comment that would ignore the personal vibes in the statement for you and let her know that marriage counseling is very hard work for the people being counseled. Part of what makes it hard work is that it's frustrating. A labeling or a linking kind of interpretation might be helpful. Since this attacks your expertise, a strong temptation would be to defend it and talk about how many successful marriage counseling cases you've handled and how much training you've had. Or on the other hand, you might choose to poor mouth yourself and talk about how you haven't really had any training at all at this, and you're just a good guy who's trying to do the best you can. The pastor's own personal feeling reaction could very easily get in the way right about at this point and cause some real difficulties in the counseling procedure. She is indeed talking about her frustrations, and she's also attacking you. No question about it, she's attacking you, and none of us likes that. For the sake of your own cool in this counseling situation, it might help some for you to label that and to say, Mrs. Johnson, you're unhappy with your situation and now you're attacking me. Do you feel I failed you? This would also be a time to talk about the structure and your contact with these people. If a sizable part of this lady's emotional problem is expressing emotion, it might be a time to cheer a bit and really surprise her and say some sanctioning noises about her new ability to express emotion. You might say, for example, finally, I think we're getting somewhere. Do you know what you just did, Mrs. Johnson? You talked about your emotions. That's what we need to do in here. Now let's look at it. One thing is rather certain. With this direct a statement from Mrs. Johnson, even though her vibes are somewhat hidden, they are there without any doubt, and one needs to do more than nod or grunt in response to a statement like this. Let's look now at another kind of response. Let's say that this is interview number 8, of a 12-session contract with a married lady who is 32, and she says,
oh, Pastor, you're so warm and understanding. I just wish Fred wasn't such a dummy. You know what he did last night? He turned to the dinner table in his undershirt. I thought all week about coming here today. It's silly, but it took me 3 hours to get ready. I took a long bath and I did my nails, and I find myself thinking about you a great deal these days.
Respond to that one, please. Turn off the machine and respond. This lady's approach might be more threatening than the direct attack or the demeaning kind of response. I would call this seductive. She's letting you know that she likes you very much. That can be flattering. It can also be threatening. You might respond with some instruction. For example, you might say, people in counseling frequently have strong feelings about their counselor. Sometimes those strong feelings are very negative, and sometimes they are very positive. That lets her know, somewhat indirectly, that you're not going to take all this at face value as though it had been said in about cocktail line. Possibly, you might want to be reflective and then add some instruction to it and say something like this. It sounds to me as though you find yourself liking me. Then reassure her by saying, of course, you know, we have an understanding with each other, and you add some structuring statements about the kind of relationship you have as her counselor and as her pastor, and that no other kinds of relationships are really possible or desired by you. If this kind of thing continues and persists, you may need to be more directive and possibly even demanding and tell her that you find it impossible to work with people who feel this way about you, and that you need them to refer her to Pastor Sauerbraten, who's 72 and lives down the street and is a very skilled and accomplished counselor. One thing you probably don't want to do is to believe her wholeheartedly when she talks about how marvelous you are. Your own wife has better data on that and can tell you how marvelous you really are. Another category that pastors see a fair amount of would be the following. Imagine a lady who is 35 years old, and this is the first time you're seeing her in counseling, and she says,
I just can't go on anymore. I could barely get out of bed this morning. The house is a wreck. Everybody hates me. I'm a mess. It's no use.
Turn off the machine now and write your response to that one. What we have here is a statement about a depressed mood. She is telling you that she feels terrible and hopeless. She needs support. She needs understanding. She needs a push, and she may need a referral to someone. The support could come in a whole variety of kinds of sentences. Theological support might be very appropriate when the pastor says something like, you know that God does not forsake us even in the valley of the shadow of death. If you wish to have more of this kind of verbalization, a simple reflection might very easily help keep it going. The pastor could say, you feel just awful, don't you? Or, you sound like you're getting close to the end of your rope. This would keep her talking, and she might begin to give you some of the details you need in order to evaluate the depth of her depression. A probing response would also be appropriate. You will want to know how well she is functioning. You could ask, are you still doing your work? Do you cook the meals? Do you do the shopping? Or if the lady is employed, are you still going to work every day? You might also want to probe about eating, sleeping, weight gain or loss. For example, sleeping 12 hours instead of 8 or 3 hours instead of 8 would be a pretty strong signal that this is a sizable difficulty. Or an unintended loss or gain of 10 pounds in the last month could start you thinking about referral, as should any other radical departure from usual functioning. Since people don't understand depression well generally and tend to think all kinds of guilty, self-incriminating, and self-punishing thoughts when they are depressed, a labeling interpretation which identifies the difficulty not as sin or personal worthlessness, but as a depressed mood might be helpful. Finally, if our pastor has evaluated this depressed mood to be not of the magnitude that he should refer, then he may want to be directive about activity and suggest to this lady that she by all means must not only continue her present level of activity, but must work more and begin getting some new positive input. Do something she enjoys. He might say to her, for example, tough as it is to get out of bed, you must get out of bed at the regular time and you must do your work. Push yourself. And then we ought to get something going for you that's fun. There should be some fun in your life. When was the last time you went to lunch with some of your girlfriends? Or when's the last time you and your husband went out to dinner alone? She needs something to look forward to, hopefully something more than her next appointment with you. Let's look now at another kind of situation. Suppose it was interview number 3, and this time with a lady who's 40 years old, and he says,
I try so hard, and then somebody always comes along and messes it up for me. Last night it was my in-laws again. They took his side against me. Even some of the kids turned in. Why am I always the one?
All right, Pastor, respond to that, if you will, for Austin C. I call this a blaming response. She is acknowledging that she has all kinds of troubles, but they're all somebody else's fault. Just reflecting that much might help her to see it, to say to her, you do have a lot of trouble, but it sounds like they're always somebody else's fault. Or you might probe a bit and add, are you sure they are always somebody else's fault? Or it could be more directly confronting and say, it can't all be somebody else's fault. What part do you contribute? Or a very simple structuring statement might help here. A pastor might say, let's talk about what you can do differently. Now let's look at one last kind of response. Imagine a situation in a first interview where a 45-year-old lady says,
well, I guess the Lord somehow means it for my good. After all, he didn't put us here to enjoy ourselves. This thing of bread is just my cross to bear.
How do you respond to that in the first interview? Turn off the machine, please, and respond. There is a fair chance that this lady is using her theology to avoid making any alteration in her life. She comes to you for counseling, and now what she's expecting from this statement is a response on your part that would sanction the whole works, and that would say, yes, indeed, Fred is your cross to bear. I strongly doubt if you would really want to agree with her on that. Behind this statement are a number of assumptions, one of which is that your brand of piety is the same as hers, which might not be the case at all. The question confronting you is, do you really want to take this bull by the horns or not? A simple reflective statement that says, you feel that that is your cross to bear might help her to see what she's really doing with this. Or you could make a clarifying statement which says, Mrs. Johnson, I think of God as a heavenly Father who loves us, yet you seem to think of God as one who's given you a heavy cross to bear. You would be adding your own theology as a corrective to hers. A low-level labeling interpretation might be helpful in which you could say, sometimes I wonder if you're using your religious ideas to help you keep things just the way they are. Or you might wish to be directive and let her know that you have heard her pious talk, but that you wish her now to consider other ways of doing things. You might say, okay, you feel that Fred is your cross to bear. I'm not sure I agree with that, but could we consider ways that you might alter things with Fred? We've been looking at a number of counselee statements and at some of the varieties of responses possible for pastoral counselors. We've looked at working statements in which the counselee is doing what he came to do, statements that are exploring, remembering, reliving, exposing, inventing. And we've looked at resisting statements in which the counselee is not doing what he came to do, denial, dependent statements, intellectualizing, attacking, demeaning, seductive, depressive, blaming, and religious statements. I hope this might help you and your counselee stay on the right track.